ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day, The Stage Show is all about multiples today. You'll discover a ballet which features several performers all playing the great Russian dancer Nijinsky. And then playwright Patricia Cornelius explains why she chose to have five actors playing WikiLeaks campaigner Julian Assange. And we start with a classic murder mystery by Agatha Christie. Hello, I'm Michael Cathcart. You're so very welcome to this special episode of The Stage Show on Radio National Summer, where we bring you all the highlights of the show over this past year. Robin Nevin AO is a tireless Australian actor and director. She's been artistic director of both the Queensland Theatre Company and the Sydney Theatre Company in the course of a long career. Her career's been all about multiples. She's won multiple awards, she's played multiple parts, and she always seems to be doing several things at once. And she joined me earlier this year as she was directing a Capital Cities tour of Agatha Christie's play, And Then There Were None. Robin Nevin, welcome to the show.
Hello, Michael, again.
Yes, every two or three years we catch up.
A reunion.
So in 2022, you directed The Mousetrap.
Yes, I did.
Which is Agatha Christie's most famous play, I guess, the longest running play in London's West End. Did you take something away from directing that play that you can apply to this?
A huge admiration for the writer, for Agatha Christie's plotting and the complexity of her characters. And just the kind of beautiful unravelling of a story. It's very well crafted. So you can rely on that. And that's, you know, that's really saying something. You go into it feeling confident that the play, if you're true to its needs, then it will unravel and present itself quite artfully.
I'm glad you said the complexity of the characters, because I think my stereotype of Agatha Christie is that she has very sort of cardboard characters, you know, the colonel and the maid and the haughty lady and so on. But as I was reading the play, I thought not only is she juggling an enormous number of characters here and I'm totally following what's going on, but they all have quite complex motivations.
Yes. The thing about The Mousetrap, and it's exactly the same with this And Then There Were None, is that each character carries with them a secret that has, to whatever extent, damaged them. Agatha Christie said, I love this quote if I'm going to be able to remember it, the human face is, after all, nothing but a mask. I may be paraphrasing a little bit. And isn't that true of all of us? We see our children grow up, we see them as they really are, and then we see them add the layers and the masks that become the adult cover for whoever they really are. And I look at you, I've got no idea what you're really thinking. I will never know what you really think, nor do I know that about the closest people to me.
I think you're marvellous. That's what I'm thinking.
Oh, actually, I did know that. You know, that idea of carrying something with you, the burden of something from your past that has caused, maybe in some cases, increasing damage to your internal mechanisms.
The other parallel between The Mousetrap and this show, And Then There Were None, is that they're both set in an isolated house. No one can get in, no one can go
trope.
Out. The old trope, yeah.
I'm not allowed to say what the plot is, so you can say, not allowed to say anything.
Oh, right. Well, I'm under
what are we going to talk about?
I'm under no obligations to anybody. Let me reveal to the audience. You can protest all you like, Robin Nevin, but this is the basic setup. This is a story about 10 people who've been brought together in a large house on an isolated island, and as the action unfolds, they're killed off one by one. And I'm not giving anything away because we learn that in the first 5 or 10 minutes. We know that they're going to die because the story keeps returning to a nursery song, which in this play is called 10 Little Soldier Boys, which is like that song, 10 Green Bottles Are Hanging on the Wall.
Yeah.
You know, one by one, they all fall over. And one by one, the little soldier boys on the mantelpiece all fall over. And you realise that every time one of them falls over, somebody dies. And that pattern set up right at the start. So we, the audience, know pretty early on that some sort of payback must be happening here. Is that it? Are you allowed to comment to that extent? Have I got it sort of right?
I don't know. You'll have to come and see it to know.
Well, all right, don't tell me what happens, but tell me this. Do you think that there's a political or satirical edge to this play, or is it just a sort of romp in the theatre?
No, I think it's much darker than that. I think the subject of accountability is at the core. And I can't elaborate on that too much because I just don't want to give the plot and the you know, which characters are accountable for what.
Okay. Let me at least give a hint. So every character in the past has killed someone, and we learned that in the past. Well, we learned that early on, Robin Nevin.
Yes, and you can see my face creasing into worried concern.
Well, Robin Nevin had no part in revealing this, whoever holds the contract. This is me. Sue me. We learn really in the first five, 10 minutes that everybody here has a murky past for which perhaps they should atone, and this may be the moment of atonement. There are, I'm going to say nothing else
good
about it, except that.
Oh, yes.
Except that. Insofar as they are representatives of British society, there's a judge, there's a ludicrous army officer, there's a fast-driving chap who's a sort of classic sort of rich toffee chap. They all show an indifference to the fate of other people. There's a cruelty to each of them.
These are not nice people. But they are. But it's still, it's an entertainment with a dark core, and it's exactly what The Mousetrap was. The Mousetrap was based on the court case of two children, that one child who died at the hands of abusive foster parents. So, and that was a real court case in England. She took that idea from that very, very dark core and wrote this very brilliant entertainment. And this is the same. It has a dark core because everybody does have a dark core to some extent. And that's what she's playing on. But it's still a clever, bright entertainment, but it's got a darkness to it.
Yeah, well, that's what makes it so satisfying, I think.
Yes, I think so.
As Agatha Christie is, because no one really dies. It's just a story, so no one's dead. But for me, it was also a satire on the British class system and the empire and all that stuff.
It's absolutely her.
I thought the politics of it were much tougher than I had expected.
She is very tough on everybody. You know, she grew up in a very privileged household, and her main, I think, you know, her main kind of, her best friends then were the staff. She was home educated and spent a lot of time in the kitchen with the staff. She came from that very stratified English class system. Yes, she absolutely comments on it. She does.
Yeah. I was blown away by just how searing the critique of these people are. And as an actor, Robin Nevin, you've always had the courage to play ugly or grotesque characters on stage. You haven't been one of those actresses who've said, my public doesn't want me to look like this and my public doesn't want me to be horrible. I've certainly heard actresses say that. You've been quite happy to go into the dark and the gnarly. Are you able to draw on that skill that you have as a performer, as a director, in order to encourage other people to reveal this prickly side?
Look, within 5 minutes of any conversation anywhere, I'll take everyone to the dark side. It's just in my nature.
That's just the Robin Nevin way.
It's just my nature. It's where I live.
Don't be fooled. This woman's not as nice as she seems. So I guess that means quite early on for the actors then you have to establish the tone of this show, because on the one hand, as you say, it's bright entertainment. On the other hand, it's
well,
got
it starts
dark,
on a very ordinary day.
Yeah.
It's just a very ordinary day with high expectations of a jolly weekend party. So that's how it starts.
And there's a lot of conversation of a rather sort of pedestrian kind. People are saying, where will I put my cases and can I help you, sir, and will you have a whiskey? And
it's the normalcy of it.
Quite a lot of that goes
on. That's the normalcy of it, yes, yes. And the expectation of a pleasurable time to come to be had by all the guests. Mm.
So as a director, you're thinking about these two issues at once, the brightness and the dark.
No, just a moment at a time.
Oh, you take it one step at a time?
Yes.
Each moment is its own thing?
Yes, of course.
Oh, that's a good rule.
Everything unfolds in its own time, and you have to give value to each moment and not project anything. I always remember there was a director called Robin Lovejoy a long, long time ago in my background in Sydney, and you knew when you went into the theatre it was going to be a heavy evening because the lighting would be kind of amber lighting from the start, and you'd get this feeling of doom and foreboding. Well, that's being predictable, you know. That's what I learnt early on.
Right. So if you have a sunny back garden and people laughing and playing tennis or something, that's just a good way to introduce something that's dark.
Well, if that's how it's written, yes.
This is the stage show. You're meeting the director, Robin Nevin. You directed for the very first time, Robin, in 1981 in a season of short new Australian plays presented at the Stables, which is a famous small theatre in Sydney. This is you talking to Andy Ross in 1981.
It's my approach to acting that I think I'll probably take over into the area of directing. The aim being to tell the story of the play simply and clearly and honestly, with as little decoration as possible. Mm. I don't think you see a lot of that. I mean, that's the ideal, and it's terribly hard to do. The simplest thing is always the hardest thing to do.
The simplest thing is always the hardest thing to do, Robin Nevin. How does that feel? Is that spooky, hearing your younger voice in your head?
Well, I don't like the voice at all. I can't believe that's... Anyway, I suppose that's who
it's
I was.
It's a little bit little girly,
but
isn't
I absolutely... Yes, and was I ever little girly?
I don't know.
But it's exactly what I would answer now.
Right, is it?
Yeah.
So you like your productions to be unadorned, pared back. Is that what you're saying?
Well, yes, in the sense of presenting the idea of the play as simply as possible. That, I mean, you know, it may look decorative, but that's a different thing. So I think I was at that time subjected to quite a lot of conceptual productions.
Meaning
productions,
what?
Productions that were, where a concept was overlaid, was laid over the kind of, you know, the simple story. So we all had to fit into some kind of concept. I think I was subjected to quite a lot of those. In the 70s, I guess.
You were rehearsing that play while you were also preparing to star as Roxanne in Cyrano opposite John Bell at the Opera House. Mm. And you talked during that interview about how you'd been directing rehearsals at the stables, bumping in during the day, starring at the Opera House at night. This does seem to be the pattern of your life, Robin Nevin. You're always doing more than one thing at once.
Yeah, I'm only doing this. I've just finished 15 months in Wicked. And during that time, I made two films, I think.
Did you?
Yeah.
As well as being Madame Morrible.
That's right, Madame Morrible. That was a joy.
Was it?
Oh, it was a complete joy. It was such a departure from anything I've ever done before. And I so loved being in a musical. The huge scale of it and the extraordinary kind of esprit de corps, it really does, you know, it really was very supportive and reassuring. I just loved it. It was hard work. I mean, 15 months of that was, it left me pretty tired.
Of doing the same thing night after night after night.
Yes, yes. And they're still doing it, you know. The stamina of these people is remarkable when they go on for years doing these huge shows.
What's it like taking on a role that's actually been created by somebody else? I know everyone says you make it your own. Well, that's fine. But still, you're wearing the costume that others have worn and others will wear after you and... Mm. And the moves are kind of given. What?
Oh, yes, the moves are absolutely given.
Yeah.
Well, because I worked with the New York director and I adored her. She was pretty brutal. She had to get this production up on in 4 weeks with some quite inexperienced performers. So she was a woman with a mission and she went at it quite, you know, head on. In fact, at one stage she was leading me around the stage by the hand, saying my words for me. That was very extraordinary. But I kind of got her. I kind of knew what she was trying to do. Well, you do carry the legacy with you, and then I suppose you put your own stamp on it.
I mean, this show, the Agatha Christie plays, the sort of show that's pretty common in the 60s when you were just starting out, everything was terribly sort of Englishy and actors all had English accents, didn't they? What stirred your enthusiasm for Australian plays? Because as I look back over your CV, as a director, as an actor, and as a person who was programming at the Queensland Theatre and the Sydney Theatre Company, you really were championing Australian plays.
Well, of course.
When did it start for you? What was the first one that drew you in?
It might have been David Williamson.
Yep.
It might have been. I mean, he was a terrific craftsman. You know, he really knew how to sling those one-liners out and make people
so
laugh.
So what, The Removalists or something early like that?
No. I don't know what my first Australian play was.
What was the first one you acted in?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I don't remember what it was.
It says here,
you'll have to tell
according
me,
to my research,
CV.
It's The Legend of King O'Malley by Bob Ellis and Michael
what
Boddy.
What a great beginning that was. That was extraordinary because I was part of the creation of that in the very first production of that when I was doing Third Year NIDA with that Rex Cramphorn group. We'd been doing Grotowski. Studying the Grotowski method,
so
which
the Grotowski
I found
method,
a nightmare. I had to be a tree at one stage, please.
This was a Polish director who was a sort of guru of acting towards a poor theatre. Is that what the book's called, the Grotowski book?
Well, maybe it was. I can't remember now. I'm going to have to do some research on myself, aren't I, Michael? But it was agony. And the group was very much invested in the study of this quite obscure kind of method. And I found it very difficult. I'd given up the theatre and come back into it, so I was not fully exercised in the practice of the art form as they were. And they were terribly earnest and terribly serious. And then we got to do this, which was vaudevillian in its style. And John Bell was very creative in creating the work as it was written. I mean, as I seem to remember it, I do remember being in the upper room in that building at the old Tote Theatre complex, and John gave us a trunk of costumes and props, like literally opened up this trunk full of bits of stuff and said, run around the room, run around the room in a great big circle around the edge of the room,
yep.
And as the spirit moves you, grab a prop and do something with it and blah, blah, blah. And that's how we kind of came up with these extraordinary clown characters. They were all kind of clowns, and I suppose we all at that time found our inner clown.
You're in a cloud, as people say. Yeah. Who was your clown?
Well, she stayed with me. I think she eventually ended up as Miss Docker in A Cheery Soul.
By Patrick White, which is one of the roles which are most famous.
Yes.
How do you mean? Tell us more about that.
I don't know. How can I explain my inner clown? You know, having started off this conversation, I go to the dark side wherever I am and as quickly as possible. Everyone's got a kind of alter ego, I suppose, and I don't know who mine is or what it is.
Well, you're an actor. You'll
it's
have
on
to have
stage.
Many.
I can't explain all of that
but
stuff.
But you do
really.
Have an inner clown, and that inner clown, is that inner clown that you discovered running around that room with John Bell and the costumes and everything when you were a young girl.
Yeah.
Is that still there, that little clown?
Yes, of course. Oh, absolutely, yeah. I love doing comedy. And I actually think I'm a character actress that's been undiscovered.
All right.
Yeah.
What character parts would you like to play?
Well, I'd like to do Lear again. Now that I'm 80, I would like to do it, but only with Barry Kosky. And that's not going to happen.
Right.
I'm telling you, it's not going to happen.
Right. Well, it might
but
too.
But my experience with him doing a production that actually came to Melbourne of the Trojan Women was very, very special in my memory of my work.
Barry Kosky, of course, being an Australian, a Melbourne-born chap who now is based in Berlin. It sounds as though you're drawn to directors who don't do the regular thing. The regular thing for directing is we all meet, we read around a table, we get to know the play, and then we sort of stand up and we act and, you know, we move around. We don't do these kind of bonding exercises, these that we used to do at drama school. That's unusual for a director actually to take a cast and put them through those kinds of processes. But you seem to like that.
Well, with him I did, because I just respected his work so much, yeah.
So it strikes me that when you, Robin, meet the cast, there you are in a room with a group of actors who may know each other, they may have former affections for each other or former enmities with each other, they may be strangers. You've got to pretty quickly bring them into a kind of intimate relationship with each other, because they're going to argue and fall in love and out of love. All those emotions are going to happen with this group of strangers. So what does a director do to create that sense of bonding or trust or openness or receptivity to these strangers?
I guess it's a bit to do with chemistry and your approach, but my approach is to not sit around the table and discuss it.
Right.
We get up straight away. We get up and move it and run it at the end of the first week.
Right.
And that's to give every actor the opportunity to have known the world of the play and the arc of the play in the first week, because very often in a slower production, in a different kind of method where you sit around and talk about it for a while and then divide into sections and analyze the sections and so on, sitting around a table, I like getting, because to act is to do, and for me it's being on the floor in relationship to the other people and relationship to the world of the play, and going, just saying the words, not acting, just saying the words right through to the end of the play that brings people. I just find that kind of brings people together.
So you think it grows, do you?
Yes, I think the trust grows, because without the pressure to act in the first week, they're kind of getting used to each other and the room. It's a tentative start in a way, because there's no pressure to actually find the character and find the emotions, but you're just absorbing into your brain who you are, who these other people are, what the world of the play is, where all the furniture in the play is, or the arches, or the what does Lear do? You know, that empty space.
The heath.
The heath. Thank you. That's where he ends up. The heath. And at the end of that first week, you've all explored that together, so you have a kind of you know.
Yeah, yeah. And not just the getting up, but starting from a point of view that's almost conversational, it sounds as though you're saying, and then building towards that more heightened emotion that the plays require of you.
Yes, it's actually more formal than that, because you are saying the words, but it's there's no pressure to find any of the emotions. You're just exploring in your mind what they are going to be. And I've always had this theory that because I've been in situations where I very had to quickly with an actor say, I love you, I love you, I love you, what I do is just get to the actor to say in the first week, I love you, I hate you, rather than fill it with any kind of emotion at all. Just know that those are the words, but eventually you're going to have to fill it.
It makes sense, actually.
It does
if I
me.
Just feel confident saying I love you into somebody's face, eventually I'll have the courage to switch on the light.
And once the play has filled you with that, the situation has filled you up, you can bring it forth.
Has the dominant style of acting changed over your career?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. I think there's a danger of too much naturalism coming into our theatres.
Meaning
what? I remember
what?
Aubrey Miller.
Hang on, naturalism. So naturalism's one of those words.
Well, yes, I know. It's not a useful word, probably. Acting that where there's an absence of the large gesture, that's the Aubrey
right.
Miller point that he was making all that time ago.
Aubrey Miller was an Australian, still is, an Australian director.
Well, you sound too much as if you're conversational in the room watching television. A lack of, I suppose, theatrical scale.
So the power of television is its ability to look like real life.
Yes.
Whereas the theatre actually, at its best often, doesn't look like real life. It looks like a play.
It celebrates a larger demonstration of life.
In which language is under more pressure and gesture is more weighty or expressive.
Yes. I can hear myself saying in the room, can you just extend that a little bit, because in a large theatre, the people at the back, even though you might be wearing a microphone, it's all going too fast. It's all going too fast and too simple. It needs to be fast and slow and clear. Not that much, but, you know, they have to have an awareness that they need to expand, not retract.
Well, television actors just connect with their face. I mean, you just have to look, you know, look to the left. And,
indeed.
And it's filled with an amazing amount of
meaning.
Meaning,
yeah,
that's right.
Indeed.
Whereas in the theatre, you've got to hit the back wall.
Indeed.
Yeah. So are you saying that the style that we see on television, that's become more common on stage?
I think so, yeah. And I would, yeah. I mean, my plays have a definition and a clarity that is more expansive than the style, if you like, we're talking about.
Robin Evan, that's where we've got to stop. Thank you so much for being my guest here on The Stage Show.
Thank you, Michael. It's been a pleasure. See you soon.
Robin Evan. And yes, earlier this year she directed And Then There Were None, a murder mystery by the ever-popular Agatha Christie. On Radio National Summer, this is The Stage Show with Michael Cathcart. Still to come, Australian playwright Patricia Cornelius wrestles with the enigma of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Well, in June last year, that's in 2024, Julian Assange returned home to Australia 14 years after he used his organisation WikiLeaks to make thousands of classified US documents public. That leak revealed details of military operations, apparent war crimes, disturbing violations of people's rights and privacy, which were republished and reported by news outlets all over the world. And over these past 14 years, we've read multiple accounts of or allegations about who Assange is. Perhaps he's a hero, perhaps he's a traitor, a champion of free press, and so on. It's a story ripe for theatre. And the veteran and ever-defiant Australian playwright Patricia Cornelius takes us there with her play called Truth. Here she joins us with her longtime collaborator, director Susie Dee. Welcome back.
Thanks,
Thank
Michael.
You.
Isn't it nice to have you here?
It's nice to be here.
When did you start thinking about this as a potential play, Patricia?
I kind of feel a bit sheepish in telling you the truth because it was such a long time ago, and so it's just taken me quite some time
to get here. In the olden days.
Yeah. Yeah.
How old am
I? Was really interested in Julian and the ideas because of WikiLeaks. And WikiLeaks seemed to me something that was quite marvellous and could alter the world potentially.
Yeah.
And so I think the germ of it was then. But and then as the incarceration continued and continued in different forms, I kind of knew there was something really smelly going on.
Did you know it would work as a play? Because it's so global and it's so not bounded in one place, whereas the theatre
No, I did not know it would work as a play. And I tried a whole lot of different versions of kind of writing a metaphorical sort of story and having inventing characters like Julia, also giving it a female perspective. But in the end, they just... It just didn't work. And I've never written for real or about real living people before. I've written about incidents that have affected the country's psyche, but I've never kind of gone there in terms of that biographical area. So it's quite new to me.
It is a kind of analysis you're carrying out.
Yeah, and also it's quite amazing even today how split people are. How people want to hold on to notions of him and they hate him and others revere him. So it's actually good dramatic fodder in the sense that we've got this real dichotomy of feeling toward him in our country in particular.
So, Susie, there are five performers playing Julian Assange. You're the director. Were you excited by that prospect? Oh,
totally. I thought, this is challenging. This is great. I think Patricia and I, have a great passion for, you know, very physical, very visceral theatre, and we sway away from naturalism a lot. So this form of having five actors play the one man was incredibly exciting, and I knew that it needed to have a lot of punch, a lot of charge in the work, because the thematics are so potent. So five voices can encapture a lot.
Well, the actors are waiting outside. We're about to bring them in. What are we going to hear? Set this up for us.
It's actually the second scene of the play. The play is they're looking at the early life of Julian Assange and the hacking community. So it's about Julian sort of reflecting on his place as an outsider when he was a child, you know, the opinions of others, the secret nature, and then he suddenly his passion, and he finds in this scene his best friend, which is the computer.
Well, let's hear how that sounds. Let's bring in the cast.
Put it to the test. Bring them in.
The cast are filing in, five of them. Here they come. Could you just introduce yourselves by name?
Hi, I'm James O'Connell.
I'm Eva Rees.
Hi, I'm Emily Haveya.
I'm Tomasz Cantor.
I'm Eva Seymour.
So the stage direction says they wear black suits with a white shirt, black tie, reminiscent of the attire of Julian Assange, and they each put up their hands to claim their title. So the first five words you'll hear are them naming themselves, and there is a language warning. There's some strong words for people who like that sort of thing in the scene that follows.
Nerd.
Freak.
Weirdo.
Geek.
Dork.
I'm about five when I knew.
I'm playing with other kids and I look around and they're not there. Pissed off. Left me talking to myself.
I'm having a conversation and I look up to vacant stares.
I've made a friend, I think, but my friend doesn't have a clue what I'm talking about.
My friend sees me coming and runs a mile.
My friend stares at me bewildered.
Like, who the fuck is this kid?
What world does this kid inhabit?
Thinking they're as excited about stuff.
As curious.
As amazed.
Even a bit interested.
But nah.
Trying hard to explain stuff.
Boring them shitless, I'm sure.
They're off, running for the door.
Got nasty. Later on, it got nasty.
For sure.
When you know a lot about something...
They don't like it.
When you know stuff they don't know...
They don't like it.
When you know they're not accurate, that they've got it wrong...
They don't like it.
Silence seemed the only solution.
Zip it.
Don't respond.
Do not utter a word.
To engage is madness.
To respond in any way invites mindless, brutish attacks.
Do not react the crap.
The endless crap they talk.
Utter bullshit that goes on and on.
About sport.
About sex.
About star signs.
About crap video games. About some shit soap they watch night after night.
To think differently is like some almighty crime.
To see solutions that others can't see.
To offer another way of thinking.
It's considered some kind of treachery.
Silence is best.
I had those who saw my silence as some kind of threat.
I had those. They took my silence as condemnation.
They were spot on.
It infuriated them.
Allowed them to spit at me, throw shit at me, punch me, trip me up.
The contrariness of it is that they want you to shut up.
And then when you shut up, they take insult at it.
Silence at times does have a certain eloquence.
When it's saying, you're not worth shit.
You're a Neanderthal.
An idiot.
An absolute dickhead.
Occasionally a comment on their inanity or stupidity or cruelty or backward bullshit spills out and in they come looking to punch or deride, wanting to silence me for good.
Truth's a dreadful thing for some.
Hurts.
To be told you're stupid.
Hurts.
Dumb.
Hurts.
Backward.
Ouch. And they'll punish you for it.
By 16, I knew I had to get out.
By 16, I knew there was no point.
By 16, I'd already missed a ton of school.
By 16, I knew that school was crap.
By 16, I knew I wasn't going back.
School? My God, what a waste of time was that?
Nerd.
Freak.
Weirdo.
Geek.
Dork.
Whatever.
What I was.
What I am.
Is smart.
Too smart.
Way too smart.
Smartest kid in the class.
The worst thing to be in this country is too smart.
You're despised.
Despised? Really?
Yeah, I reckon.
Can't be thinking you know more than anyone.
Can't be telling people they're wrong.
Well, wasn't that fantastic? Five performers bringing you the complexity of Julian Assange in the new play Truth by Patricia Cornelius and directed by Susie D. Now, later in the show, we're going to discuss a ballet about the Russian dancer Nijinsky, in which there are several dancers all playing Nijinsky, many dancers playing one guy, to give you a sense of a fragmented person. It's a powerful device. Are you after a similar effect here?
I think there's definitely a variety of colours and nuance within the voices and within the choral work of the Julians. I don't think they're not different characters as such, but definitely it gives you an all-rounded variation on persona of Julian.
Yeah,
do you agree,
yeah,
Patricia?
Yeah, I do.
So he joins this kind of online community of freaks and dorks and weirdos.
Often male, dominated at the time, and often very smart, really, you know, quite not interested in school because they're way beyond it in some ways.
And they feel they're smart together in a way the rest of the world isn't.
Yeah.
They have a sort of fraternity of smartness.
Maybe a bit too smart sometimes. Yeah. But
I think when they get together, the hacking community, I feel like it was, I don't know if they had a political intention to crack open the big secrets of the world.
I think there's a sense of gorgeous naivety about being able to find out or to enter places where you're forbidden.
At what stage of the story did it take on a moral dimension then? When did they develop a moral code, the people around Julian?
Well, Julian himself, I think when he had a lot of whistleblowers telling him numerous things about the world that was staggering, and then the world didn't react and the press didn't really react either. I think then he sees that he has to really work hard to be able to find the way to get it out there, to keep it from being just buried and not given it its due. That kind of moral, the world should know, the public should be
But also
informed.
The world should react, it should respond, and it's not. He's making this stuff public and people are not...
Ignoring those things.
Okay, we'll give them the whole deal.
Yeah, and I guess that's the bigger moral question, just because you've brought it up now, is that that's what we're all afraid of, is that we've stopped really caring, that we kind of do know the state of the world and we just pour another drink of wine.
Yeah. So there's a scene in the play where we hear audio of a group of soldiers going into a situation where they end up killing people who are wounded.
Yeah.
And it's quite chilling to hear. What's the source of that material?
That's Chelsea Manning, who's released it when she was a soldier in Iraq, and so she released a thing called Collateral Murder, and it is a devastating depiction of a war crime, the US mowing down a number of Iraqis who are in the street.
Yeah. So the play is primarily about Julian Assange, but it's also, as you say, about the activities and the fates of the whistleblower Chelsea Manning, and also later on Edward Snowden, another whistleblower, another person who leaked material. So we do have a sense of a community, of a kind of global movement. That's the genius of the play, I reckon, that you've managed to create a sense of something that's happening across the world.
Good. And that there are the whistleblowers that are trying to give voice to these serious crimes, these serious atrocities, and then I think in the play it looks at the punishment of those whistleblowers. What is it to what happens when you speak up, when you really speak up, when you reveal, you know, what's happening? You know, we're not revered, are we? Those people are, you know, are shut down, are silenced. And I think that's the big thematic in the work, isn't it, Patricia?
Being silenced.
Being silenced.
Did you come away thinking there were issues about Julian Assange that were hard to account for? There are so many versions, as you say, of who he is.
I knew that I had to deal with the rape accusations from in Sweden, that was really important because people still very stuck with that. I mean, they assume all sorts of things. They've not moved on from the fact that he was never charged or for the other factors around that.
So what do you make of that? We should say that the prosecution dropped the case and Julian strenuously denied the allegations. But what did you come away from it all thinking?
I felt I was very influenced by a writer named Nils Melzer, and who worked for the UN and who's written a book about Julian, quite supportive of Julian, but who sort of reminded his readers that these are women who, that they're kind of manipulated, or not kind of manipulated, they're absolutely manipulated and ambushed by the Swedish media and government, and there was another intention going on. And so, but at the same time, they wanted a certain thing to happen, and it got actually taken out of their hands.
Hang on, you're being a bit cryptic there. What do you mean the women wanted a certain thing to happen?
They basically wanted Julian to have an HIV test.
Right.
And so they were thought that they'd work for to pressure that, pressure him through the police. And it just
But backfired. They did want him to be held accountable for something.
I don't quite know, because one of the biggest things about it, about the material is that, in fact, nothing has been recorded by them directly. So all the accounts are written by the police that have interviewed them. There's a lot of contradictions in the case. I don't feel like that's my role to kind of solve it, but I'll just to place it out there, because if I don't, people will think that I'm avoiding it purposefully,
right.
and it sticks in their mind. But it really, I think it's about people listening to what else is going on, and they can make their own decision about it.
You dramatise the impact of the years of confinement in a London embassy and the legal struggles that raged around him. And we will have to say that the truth is complex. I mean, people sit in the studio every week, I guess, and tell me that the truth is complex. Is that how you've come away from this project, feeling that there are many truths, or is part of you sort of toughening up and saying, actually, this is about the truth? You know, what he revealed was the truth, because you've called the play Truth. So you're obviously inviting some kind of discussion or reflection on what the nature of truth is.
I'm going for it. I see it as the truth.
Right.
Yeah. Even though I will say it's always tricky. There's always another perspective that you might not have considered. There's other opinions. I hope that's what happens. You know, when you go to the theatre, like we do, we all do, and sometimes you come out and you never mention that show ever again. It sort of doesn't do anything.
Oh, you forget
you.
The next morning what you've seen.
And then there's others that you kind of come out just wanting to understand more or to question things, even if you didn't like it. It's sort of least stimulating. And that's what I hope for, is that the truth. But you can't be too wishy-washy with the stuff. You know, I couldn't say, where's my bias? Clearly, you've read it. You know where my bias is. So, and I don't mind that. You know, there's some notion that artists and playwrights shouldn't have a political opinion. Well, bugger off, like we do. You know, it's funny how, of all the things that he attacks on him, nobody talks about what's been revealed. So there's sort of like a way of, there's no analysis of actually the war crimes or our involvement, and including Australian troops as well, in Iraq and Afghanistan. No questioning of how things were operating there. Why not? We're going to talk about these other things about him. It is a really funny thing of look over there. Look over there. Yeah. Here we've got the murder of 8 or 9 men in the street, clearly, and it's leaked. And that's not that blood's not talked about. And it's never addressed. Yeah. They've never been taken charged. And so it's all about him and what he's done. So you don't look there.
I don't think I don't think Patricia's glorifying him and covering up all that. You, as a political audience member, might have wanted to hear more about all those negative aspects of Assange. But I feel like Patricia's focusing on all the positives, all the amazing things that have been revealed.
The stuff that has to be dealt with, you say.
Yeah, I know about how we silence things. We silence people. You know those days when whistleblowers were considered just courageous and bold and we were grateful for them. And now the threat of going to jail is so huge and there's a kind of shift in mentality towards it, as if they're somehow at fault, rather than what they're revealing is revealing the fault of organisations, of companies, of governments, of armies. There's a different kind of smell in the air in terms of trying to change things.
Patricia Cornelius and Susie D, my guests earlier this year on The Stage Show. And Truth, Patricia's play about Julian Assange, premiered at the Malthouse Theatre in Melbourne last February. The Russian Vasilav Nijinsky was one of the greatest, one of the most famous, most talked about ballet dancers of the first half of the 20th century. He was just captivating when he danced. He was modern and timeless all at once. But he was also living with mental illness. And after the age of 30, he was so unwell that he never danced again. So who was he? A genius? A free spirit? Perhaps a tortured soul? Earlier this year, principal dancer at the Australian Ballet, the lithe, charismatic Callum Lennane, reprised his role as Nijinsky in a ballet which is called simply Nijinsky, created by the great American choreographer John Neumeier, who lives in Germany and who returned to Australia to reconjure this mercurial work. Let's revisit that interview by welcoming Callum Lennane to the stage show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Has it all come back to you?
Yeah, a lot of it has come back, which is quite remarkable.
How's that?
I don't know. I was talking to someone yesterday in the studio about it. They said, oh, it seems like you've remembered most of this. And I said, yeah, which is crazy. I think the memory becomes quite selective because there are some ballets that have exited my mind within months of finishing them, but this one has stayed in there.
Yeah, well, you're not a prince in this one.
Yeah, exactly. It's more fun.
In the Nijinsky. So, I mean, he had this incredible reputation, didn't he? It's almost as if he was a mystical force, as though he could fly. As you researched him, I guess you read about him, what struck you about him? What did you seize on when you were thinking, how am I going to portray this guy?
I mean, to audiences and to those around him who witnessed him, just how utterly transformative he was. And that is what seems to have stuck in sort of the people who, you know, recount his performances, that obviously he had this amazing, beautiful, strong technique, which was a sight to behold in itself. But what people seem to remember is just when he would become these other characters, like the Spectre de la Rose or Afternoon of a Faun, that he would completely and utterly transform on stage. And it would happen right before he got on stage, when he put the costume on, they would say. He would sort of really become these other characters, these other people.
Like an animal almost he could be. Yeah. And so controversial.
Mm.
Why so controversial?
Because he was so ahead of his time. I think what the controversy was in the choreography that he started creating. And it was really, I think, the beginnings of what modern dance became. He kind of wanted to leave behind the classicisms of the day. You know, already Fokine was taking ballet in a different direction, but that seemed to not be enough for Nijinsky. And he wanted to kind of really recreate dance. And as we see in Afternoon of a Faun, for example, everything is very two-dimensional, in profile, not not virtuosic at all, which I think is remarkable because he was such a virtuosic dancer.
You're doing gestures there. There are famous photographs of him standing almost like a classical figure on a vase with his...
completely side on and everything.
Yeah, like one of those Egyptian figures, actually, but he's dressed as this faun and he just looks like a painting or a frieze or something.
Really, yeah.
This story's always told, so we better tell it. There was rioting in the theatres of Paris during his performance of Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring.
Yeah. So he was the choreographer of Rite of Spring. It was a new score by Stravinsky. And, yeah, you're correct. In the theatre in Paris, there was, I mean, that they, at least in what I read about it, there was almost like two factions in the audience. There was those who were loved it and in support of it, and then those who absolutely hated it. And the two groups were, I don't want to say they were brawling, but it was a riot.
I think they were brawling.
It was a riot.
I think you can say brawling. They were just heaving into each other. I mean, he's not alone, too. Nijinsky's found his company, too, hasn't he? Because he's in this company, the...
Ballet Russe, yeah.
Which was looking for a kind of sensuality and a modernity, wasn't it? And they were his mob, really.
They were. I mean, and Diaghilev founded that company, the Impresario, and I think he really was just a visionary and incredibly forward-thinking and was always... trying to find a new way, you know, a modern way. And, you know,
and they're using modern designers and modern composers.
Yeah, it's all new, it's all fresh.
And sexual.
Yes. Again, to use Afternoon of a Faun as an example, it finished with Nijinsky sort of having a sexual climax at the end of the ballet, and that was completely shocking.
Again, people rioted, yeah. Let's hear some of Afternoon of a Faun. Afternoon of a Faun by Claude Debussy. We can't talk about him really without contemplating this sexual allure that he had, the effect he had on both men and women. I wonder what you make of that.
In reading about him and you know, going on the sort of character journey arc in the ballet, there was such a naivety to Nijinsky and a kind of purity. And I think with that, he was... I mean, it's hard to say whether he was or not, but almost taken advantage of and pulled in certain directions. You know, we know that, or we believe that he had a sort of a sexual relationship with Diaghilev, but it's difficult to know whether he was doing that because that was his sexuality or because he was sort of taken under Diaghilev's wing, if that makes sense. And so,
well, he got married to a woman later.
Yeah, and then he got married to a woman later on. So, but it does make it makes it a very interesting person to portray.
Well, also a very interesting time, because I wonder whether we shouldn't think of him as a kind of modern-day celebrity. Hmm. You know, there's a kind of role or an image, a kind of public self that's projected onto him.
Yeah.
And he's, as you say, he does seem to have been a sort of naive, pure-hearted artist who becomes this focus for other people's sexual fantasies. They're able to project things onto him.
Yeah.
And if that's what happened, then the idea that he then suffers from mental illness and has a breakdown.
Mm.
I don't know. I'm not qualified to diagnose people, but...
No, but I think you're onto something.
But it's making sense to me.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. Because he was definitely a celebrity, but from what I read about, he... You know, I mean, I don't know what the true personality of a celebrity is, but it seems like he wasn't fit for the idea of celebrity. Do you know what I mean? It's like he wanted to just do his... art, and he really lived for his art and his dancing and his choreography, but there was all this other stuff that sort of came with it, and, you know, being in the public eye and the limelight and people wanting to pull you this way and that way. And yeah, it seemed like he wasn't quite equipped for it.
So the choreographer of this dance that you're performing in, which is called Nijinsky, is John Neumeier, who is an extraordinary force in European ballet. He was the director and principal choreographer of the Hamburg Ballet in Germany from 1973 until last year.
Isn't that crazy?
So how have you worked with him? How's that played out?
I worked with him for the first time 9 years ago. And I was already a huge fan of him and his work when I was a teenager at ballet school. There was just something about his choreographic language and also about the way his ballets always look from a design perspective. To me, I was just always such a fan of.
But they had a sort of fresh robustness.
Yeah, I think he takes like, and even, you know, certain ballets like Lady of the Camellias were choreographed in the 1970s and they still stand up today because there's a certain sort of classical storytelling, but there's always been a modernity to it.
I really get this. I mean, it is a bit like that division we were talking about in Paris back in the day, you know, of Stravinsky, because there are people who love to go to the ballet and see the old, you know, princes and princesses, relics. And I really don't. I mean, I go to the ballet and I think, oh, you know, okay, these guys are very good. They are very good, these people. They're very, very, they are very good. But I have seen this all before. And I love going to the theatre and thinking, oh, my God, I didn't know that was possible.
I completely agree. I'm the same. I'm a dancer and I have the same opinion. I have to do some of the older pieces from the repertoire as part of my job, but they're not the ones that I really truly love because I think, no, they can sometimes feel a bit like an artefact and I prefer to do the more modern contemporary ways.
So do you imagine that the audience will come away from this ballet having their sense of what ballet can be enlarged?
Yes, absolutely.
In what way? What will we see that we think, oh, I didn't know that could happen?
It's a story about a man, about a real life person, but it's not so much a biographical ballet. And I think that the choreographer John Neumeier describes it really well. He calls it the ballet is a biography of the soul.
But you do feel as though you're in his headspace.
Absolutely. The ballet begins and ends in the same space in what we call the Savretta House, which was where Nijinsky performed his final dance work in Switzerland.
So all these fragments of a life are like memories that won't properly organise themselves.
Yeah. And then the way they're linked together, I just think is so creative and so clever. And I believe Act Two really, you lose a majority of the set pieces. And it's a very vast, open stage. It's my favourite costumes I've worn in ballet because I play him as Nijinsky the man. And so all my costumes are sort of like trousers and suits. And I love dancing in pants and shirts and jackets. But then the way that the ballet is done, there are other dancers who portray his roles. So I'm Vaslav Nijinsky as a man, and then another dancer portrays Vaslav as the golden slave and the fawn, and then another dancer.
All famous roles.
Yeah. So it's.
Oh, everyone gets to be Nijinsky.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, even better.
I'm just sort of the one who.
You're the one in the middle. You're the hub and they're all the spokes.
Yeah, so they do all the really beautiful dance numbers and I gradually go a bit crazy. But I still think it's the best gig to have.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it just sounds like a wonderful role.
It really is a creative, I think, like a stroke of genius in getting many dancers to portray one.
Callum Lenane, one of the many Nijinskys.
Yeah, that's it.
Callum Lenane, principal artist with the Australian Ballet, recalling the great Russian dancer, Nijinsky. And that's Curtains for this week. You've been hearing interviews that I recorded throughout the year, the final year of the stage show. Do join me next Tuesday for another Summer Highlights episode of our show. And you can listen anytime by following us on the ABC Listen app, where there's just so much great stuff to enjoy. We can't bring it all to you over the summer, but there are so many highlights there that you can go back and listen to all over again. The program is produced for ABC Radio National by Rosa Ellen, and I'm Michael Cathcart. See you next time we get together to share our love of the theatre. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.